The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Miss Randier, why the halfling? Galadriel asked. I don't know, Gandalf replied. Sauron believes that it is only through the exercise of great power that evil can be resisted. But I have found in my experience a different thing. It's the good things, the small acts of kindness that turns back the power of evil. Why Bilbo Baggins? I don't know. Perhaps it is because I am afraid, and he gives me courage. I couldn't help but think of that as Christian was speaking just a moment ago. For the first time in 15 years, have missed the beginning of the ACCS conference, and I feel altogether out of my depth. I'm having to jump into the deep end of the pool, and I haven't even dipped my toes in yet. And yet, already I'm invigorated. Thank you, Christian. That was really wonderful. In addition, this is at least the third, maybe the fourth time we've shared a platform just this year. So I feel like we've got a great partnership going. If you're going off to Idaho, I don't know how I'm going to continue to do this all by myself. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was transformed during the horrific years he spent in Stalin's gulags, the brutal Soviet prison was supposed to break him, like it had so many tens of thousands of other Russians before him. But almost from the beginning, Solzhenitsyn was determined that instead the prison camps would make him as a writer, as a thinker, as a Christian, as a man. And so it did. He learned a myriad of lessons whilst there in the maws of ideological totalitarianism, of arbitrary absolutism, of unmitigated evil. They were lessons that he would not trade for the world. He learned, for instance, the value of things in this world, of the permanent things, the things that matter most. He wrote, that which is called humanism, but would be more correctly called irreligious anthropocentrism, cannot yield answers to the most essential questions of our lives. You see, we always pay dearly for chasing after what is cheap. Solzhenitsyn also learned the blessing, the paradoxical blessing of adversity. He wrote, "Bless you, prison. Bless you for being in my life, for there, lying upon the rotting prison straw, I came to realize that the object of life is not comfort and prosperity, as we are made to believe, but the maturity of the human soul and the stirring of the imagination. You should therefore rejoice, O soul, that you're in prison, for here you have the time to think, the time to think of your own soul. You see, you can have eyes and still not see, but a hard life improves vision." Perhaps most importantly, Solzhenitsyn learned the value of time while he was in Stalin's gulags. Every single moment that passes is so incredibly precious. He wrote, "Persecution and oppression, like all adversity, temper a man's perspective of time. We begin to grasp the smallness of temporality and the largeness of eternity. We slowly learn to balance patience with urgency and urgency with patience, without diminishing the importance of either. We learn what it means to live at a kingdom pace, deep and slow. Alas, these are lessons that far too few of us ever learn. I was waiting for my flight yesterday afternoon. It was delayed, and I was sitting in Atlanta. Everything seems to go through Atlanta. If you're going from Portland to San Francisco, I'm convinced they'll make you stop in Atlanta first. The old joke was that that even the rapture stops in Atlanta. Talk about a fairy tale. So I'm sitting there at my gate in Atlanta, and you know how Atlanta is. It's so busy. It's people running to and fro. But my gate was eerily silent. I looked up to try and figure out why it was so silent. Nobody was talking. Everyone was looking at their phone. Half of them had their headphones plugged in. Some of them were sitting with families. I mean, we were on our way to Orlando. I mean, this is the Disney crowd. Nobody's talking, not even the kids. It's hard to learn the lessons that Solzhenitsyn learned when you never give yourself room to even think, to live at a kingdom pace, deep and slow, requires something far more than what we've made room for in our lives. Kingdom living, kingdom pace, it's not a particularly apt description of most of our lives. Again, as Solzhenitsyn observed, that hastiness and superficiality are the psychic diseases of modernity. Indeed, our hastiness, our frenetic busyness, essentially demands our superficiality. You've no doubt heard it 1,000 times, haven't you? It's practically become our standard American greeting. Hey, how you doing? No, fine, busy, really busy, crazy busy, but fine. Yeah, me too. Fast and furious, busy to the point of exhaustion, driven by the tyranny of the trivial, and never quite catching up. But we're all very, very conversant in what Orwell called the centrifugal bumble puppies, but the substance of life, the things that we actually care about, they escape us altogether. It's pretty much become par for the course. We hardly know how to rest unless, of course, we somehow manage to escape for a week, a year to a condo at the beach or a cabin at the mountains, and even then we start getting real twitchy toward the end. And if the Wi-Fi connection is lousy, it's a crummy vacation altogether. We're like the white rabbit in Alice's Wonderland, aren't we? Oh dear, I shall be too late. Somehow, some way, we've got to learn what Solzhenitsyn learned. We need to learn the rhythms of fasting and feasting, of working and resting, of pressing on and pressing in. We need to recalibrate our lives to a kingdom pace. The liberal social critic and campaigner Jeremy Rifkin has convincingly argued that one of the strangest disparities of history lies between the sense of abundance felt by earlier, simpler Christian societies and the sense of scarcity felt by the ostensibly richer societies of secular modernity. He attributes that gap to what he calls time wars. It is, he says, a radical shift in worldview and thus a radical shift in our understanding of the value of past, present, and future, moving away from a linear Christian view of time to a more pagan, cyclical, or perhaps a kind of catastrophic view of time. And therefore, our work and our productivity, our efficiency, our lives, the narrative of our understanding of what is good and true is thrown off kilter. It's as if we've maddeningly stepped into that busy London street that Chesterton describes, so far from fairyland that we can no longer imagine the fairy tale ending, much less the fairy tale life that leads up to it. No matter how we arm ourselves with planning tools and strategic initiatives or productivity coaching, we can practice the habits of highly effective people. We can get things done. Somehow swim with the sharks, and we can even move the cheese. But we never seem to be able to do anything more than rage against the machine. This, Rifkin asserts, is the result of our dramatic shift away from the substantive Christian perspective of time, from what Solzhenitsyn called living at a kingdom pace, deep and slow. The truth is that the kingdom pace requires a, an extraordinary balance between urgency and patience. But virtually every biblical injunction about the use of time underlines the importance of each moment that passes. It's imperative for us to act and act decisively when lives are at stake, when justice is perverted, when truth is in jeopardy, when souls are endangered, and when the gospel is assaulted. We're admonished to make the most of our time, Ephesians 5, to redeem the time, Colossians 4, to utilize every day to the utmost, Hebrews 3. I confess that I'm of the generation that can hardly read Ecclesiastes 3 without hearing the birds singing it. I keep looking for that place in the scriptures where it says, turn, 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 turn. It's not there. But what I do find there is this glorious call to sanctify the time with an extraordinary balance. According to the Bible, our time is not our own. It's not ours to dispose of as we choose. We've been bought with a price, 1 Corinthians 6. Thus, we are to set our lives apart for the Lord and his glory, Romans 4. To reinforce this notion, the Lord gave his people a kind of clock to organize and to give flow to their lives. In the Old Testament, the days were divided into 8 distinct periods: dawn, morning, midday, dark, evening, and 3 night watches. These were distinguished by times and seasons of prayer, as we see in the book of Daniel or in Psalm 55. In the New Testament, this value is reinforced all the more. A kind of liturgical clock is affirmed by the followers of Christ, who punctuated the urgent task of evangelism and discipleship with the discipline of regular spiritual refreshment. See this in Acts 2, 3, and 4. But it was not just the days. In addition, the weeks of God's people were ordered with purposeful sanctity. In the Old Testament, the week centered on the Sabbath and its attendant sacrifices. In the New Testament, the week revolves around the Lord's Day and the sacraments. Thus, each week has its own pace, schedule, priorities, and order. Thus, believers were able to give form to function and function to form. It enabled them to run and not be weary. Even the years were given special structure to reinforce the biblical conception of decisive action, of kingdom pacing. In ancient Israel, feasts and fasts and festivals that paced the community of faith and its progression through the months. The early church continued this stewardship of time, punctuating the years with particular seasons: Advent, Christmas, Epiphany, Lententide, Easter, Ascension, and Pentecost. Thus, God's people were enabled and equipped to run the race, Philippians 2, and fight the fight, Ephesians 6, finish the course, 2 Timothy 4, and to keep the faith, 2 Timothy 3. But all of this ordering was balanced on the whole by an extraordinary emphasis on resting. Truth is that the Bible is constantly reminding us we need not be anxious, Philippians 4. We need not worry, Matthew 6. We need not fret, Luke 12. Instead, we are to rest and rely on God's very great and precious promises, 2 Peter 1. We're to trust in his sovereign working, and indeed know that all things will be made right, Romans 8, and that in his good providence, none of his purposes will by any means be thwarted, Ephesians 1. Such is the characteristic of a kingdom pace of life. Living at a kingdom pace, practicing the patience of the Lord God in the midst of grave needs of urgency is one of the attributes of God himself, as we see in 2 Peter 3. In addition, though, it is a command from on high, a non-optional mandate for every believer, Ephesians 4. It's a fruit of the Spirit, Galatians 5. It's an evidence of love, 1 Corinthians 13. It's a sign of comfort, 2 Corinthians 1. And it's a qualification for mature biblical leadership, 2 Timothy 2. Therefore, in times of persecution, 1 Peter 2, suffering, James 5, confrontation, 1 Thessalonians 5, patience is to be the Christian's overriding concern. It's not the sort of message that we typically hear in our board meetings, is it? We want everything now. We want to somehow extract ourselves from our cultural designer disaster now, in the next graduating class. We want to see the George Whitfields and the Peyton Randolphs and the John Knoxes now. By golly, they've made it all the way from 6th grade to 12th. Why aren't they suddenly changing the whole world? We want it now. We're to endure in patience, Revelation chapter 3. We're to clothe ourselves in patience, Colossians chapter 3. The pace we set must be steady, because the task we face will not soon be dispatched. All through the scriptures, this lesson is emphasized. Rest in the Lord and patiently wait for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Yet a little while, and the wicked man will be no more. But the humble will inherit the land and will delight in abundance. Psalm 37. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and better a patient man than a warrior who captures the city. Colossians 16. Wisdom makes a man patient, Proverbs 19. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit, Ecclesiastes 7. By patience, a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue breaks the bone, Proverbs 25. G.K. Chesterton tells this wonderful parable, fairy tale. It's a story of a man named Thomas Smythe. You may have heard it before. It's a great classic. It's worth retelling again and again and again. See, Thomas lived in a little Golden Valley, a small white cottage set in the midst of that Golden Valley, with the purple hills behind and a little picket fence out in front. He labored long and hard every day, and it was wearying work, difficult work. But his wife and his children were thriving in the midst of it all. Alas, over time, though, Thomas couldn't see the Golden Valley any longer. He, He could only see the mold and the mildew that was growing just under the eaves of the thatched roof. He couldn't see the beauty of his children any longer. They looked grubby and difficult to him. The house smelled of fish. For his wife, that never seemed to clean up quite the way that he would like her to clean up. And his eyes grew dim. His heart grew cold. And one day he set out through the wicket gate to go and find the perfect world. Part of Thomas's problem, Chesterton tells us, is that he labored day and night, and all of his labors had turned to drudgery. Now he would go and find the fairy tale ending that he'd always imagined for his life. Of course, he skipped a step, which is the fairy tale life that leads to the fairy tale ending at the end of his life. And so he went searching all over the world. He went from town to town and from land to land. He crossed great rivers and eventually great seas. And everywhere he went, there was only weariness. And as the time wore on, he became more and more anxious, and the labors became more and more difficult, until one day he crested a hill and he looked down on a valley. It was astonishing to his sight. It was the most beautiful thing that he'd ever seen before in his life. It was a golden valley, and there was a little white cottage set in the midst of it, and behind it, the purple hazy hills. There were children playing in the yard behind a little picket fence, and he thought to himself, "Oh, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life." He ran down the hill, and he made his way toward the picket fence, and the children looked up with a gleam of recognition, and they ran to him, and then a woman, the most ravishingly beautiful woman he had ever seen in his life, stepped out under the moldy eaves and said, "Welcome home, Thomas Smith." That now was home. But all of us yearn for that. All of us really, the reason that we educate our children, the reason that we learn Latin, the reason that we gather textbooks by the yard, the reason that we come to these conferences to hear speakers that only make our heads explode, is because we yearn for that moment when we come to the little cottage in the Golden Valley and know that we are home. Of course, the question is, why don't we live like that? Well, it's because all of us have just a little too much of Thomas Smythe in us, and we grow restless, and we become frenetic, and we run hither and yon, and we never fully take it in. We don't allow our imaginations to run. We don't put ourselves in the way of grace because we're so busy trying to manufacture our own version of grace. For the next generation, for those children that we love and sacrifice so much for, we're going to have to provide for them an entirely different model. In order to multiply our efforts and magnify our impact, We're going to have to start to live all of the stuff that we teach. It's going to mean that we're going to have to slow down a bit, or perhaps set aside some of our grand plans and strategic initiatives just for a moment so that we can breathe. I love the way God helps us in the Word to recalibrate our schedules so that the Thomas Smythe in us can somehow find Sabbath rest. He does it largely with food. Have you ever noticed that? There's nothing quite as effective in ministry or in life, nothing quite as effective in recalibrating the clocks of our lives as fellowship around the table. In the hustle and bustle of everyday life, nurturing covenant community is no easy task. Missional and relational rootedness requires deliberateness and intentionality. It can be hard and messy work, but the truth is that the men and women and families that we most would like to see come into our little covenant communities, into our schools and churches, are far more likely to be attracted to the vibrancy of our relationships than the incisiveness of our vision statements or the creative applications of our models or the oratorical brilliance of our teachers. That's why we should eat together, regularly, joyously. Now, I confess to you a bias right at the start. I love food. I love everything about food. I love eating it, of course. But I also love talking about it, thinking about it, reminiscing about it. I love the social traditions that surround good meals. I love the kind of fellowship that can only be shared around the dinner table or across a picnic table or beside the kitchen counter or over the stove. And my guess is that I'm not alone. Of course, apart from the obvious sensate attractions, food is supremely spiritual. Consider the fact that we can hardly read a single page of Scripture without running into a discussion of bread and wine, or milk and honey, or leeks and onions, or glistening oil and plump figs, or sweet grapes and delectable pomegranates, roast lamb and savory stew. Everywhere we look, there are feasts and celebrations, fatted calves and pungent herbs, loaves and fishes. Think about how many ways the Lord uses food to preach the gospel to our hearts and lives. Faith is defined by hungering and thirsting. Covenant is defined by hospitality and community. The pinnacle of worship is the gathering of God's people around his table. The culmination of the history of redemption is a wedding supper. And have you ever noticed that nearly all of Christ's post-resurrection appearances occurred at meals? Remember, Jesus did not say, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock, and if anyone opens the door, I will enter in and discuss theology with him." Oh, no. Instead, Jesus said, "I will come in and sup with him." What a difference. It's always delightful for me to consider the fact that one of the surest indications of a healthy covenant love in a church or in a school is the appearance of saints bearing casseroles. In times of joy, in times of sorrow, in times of celebration, there is nothing quite like the power of food to facilitate a deeper and richer sense of our callings together. Has it ever struck you how paradoxical it is when we gather together at what ostensibly is the saddest moment of life, at a funeral, and there is this undercurrent of deep joy, not the super spiritual, oh, we grieve, but not as those who have no hope kind of joy, the kind of joy of seeing the people that you never get to see any other time, and being able to reconnect and find out about kids and grandkids and cousins and uncles. And the food. Oh, the food. And standing over a table loaded down with a Garrison Keillor kind of weightiness. We say to each other, we really shouldn't just wait for funerals to get together to do this. Why, it's been, what, 8 years? 10 years? No, 12 years? Really? 12 years since we've told one another stories, exchanged reminiscences? Really? What have we been doing? Well, busy. Really busy. Crazy busy, but good. What are we thinking? How do we expect our children, our students, our disciples to be able to walk with a kingdom pace, to slow down enough, to get deep enough, to actually be enraptured again by reapy cheap? How do we expect them to go on to college and not have this kind of frenetic corporate mindset that we've got to achieve, without ever realizing that the greatest achievements occur when they're properly paced and properly appreciated. Yes, God has called us to go forth and change the world by changing our students. But we've got to transmit to them a way of being and a way of seeing, a way of living as much as a way of thinking, a way of writing, and a way of speaking. There's a little bit of Took and a little bit of Baggins in all of us. This is why we so identify with Bilbo. Should we stay back in the hobbit hole, smoking the pipe and having the larder full of all of our favorite foods so that we can have second breakfast if we want to? Or should we launch out on that grand adventure? Rush headlong out into the world, realizing that the road goes ever on and on. From a biblical perspective, it's not an either or question. See, that's the thing about the kingdom pace of deep and slow. When we live as we ought to live, then we can achieve as we ought to achieve. When we're able to slow down enough, to think deeply enough, to cast a vision that is farsighted enough and lay hold of destiny that is strong enough, then we can actually go forth and do it. Not be exhausted in the process, so that the crowded hours of life are properly punctuated with great joys. G.K. Chesterton also tells the wonderful story, saying that the world is simultaneously an ogre's castle which must be stormed. And it's a cottage in the wood to which one might return after a long day's labor, where a welcoming hearth fire and a filling meal await. It's both, he says. Most of us live in one world or the other, but living at a kingdom pace, going deep and slow, enables us to embrace both. Life in this poor fallen world is, he said, both a battle and a refuge. It is at the same time a dangerous enterprise and a restful repose. Living at a kingdom pace enables us to appreciate both simultaneously. We need to schedule regular times for our folks, our teachers, our parents, our students who are weary, to eat together, cook together, share recipes together, read books that are not on the summer reading list together. We need to barbecue together. We need to nosh together. We need to embrace the richness and the fullness and the beauty of life to reinforce the rhythm of the seasons, the patterns of the gospel through the course of the years and the generations. Our folks need to rediscover the wonder of table talk, of long walks in the woods, of the meandering course of delightful conversation, of days on end with no cable TV and no Wi-Fi and no iPhone. Wait. I'll get that later. Taste and see that the Lord, he is good. Don't you love that old Randy Travis song? Amazing grace, oh, how sweet the sound. There was glory in the air, and there was dinner on the grounds. As you walk with your students, show them the pace that you yearn for them to have. We have fairy tale lives with battles. There are dragons galore. They must be slain. The longbows need to be at the ready in the moment when the enemy assaults, but then at the end of the day, unstring the bow. Go home to the cottage in the wood. Rest. Laugh from the deep bottom of your hearts. And that will teach your students far more than the lessons from the first semester that they've already forgotten. God bless you.
Thank you all, and have a good rest of the day. And thanks for encouraging us so much, George.